Hey, this is Meredith. You know, some stories are so outrageous, they seem like they're just made for television. That is true of the story that we're going to share today from the archives. Kenji Gallo grew up in Southern California, and through a series of events and circumstances, he found himself working for the mafia. At first, it seemed like it was really glamorous, but that shine wore off and the danger began to take its toll. So we're going to be back in a couple of weeks with more new episodes of The Unfolding, but for now, enjoy this incredible story from the archives. Page 32 of The Unfolding is the story of Kenji Gallo.
You know that you're going to get arrested, you're going to get killed, we're going to put you away for life. And I said, yeah, I know. And I go, well, what do I get out of it? And they said, only thing you're going to get out of this whole deal is a fresh start. And he goes, just like this, woof. End of everything, new you.
God's story has been unfolding.
Since the beginning of time.
He invites you to be a part of it.
Another page in the unfolding.
Kenji Gallo says as far back as he could remember, he felt empty. So when he saw the leaders of organized crime, how respected they were, the money, the power, he knew he wanted that. By the time Kenji was a teenager, he was well on his way to a life of crime, a life that eventually led him to a place in the mafia, and a life that seemed to have no way out. Here's Kenji.
I grew up in an upper middle class area in a place called Irvine, California. And I was just different than everyone. I decided that I just wanted to be a criminal.
Really?
And yes. Well, I read the stories and I just looked up to those kind of guys, watched the movies kind of, and I thought about, you know, being like Al Capone and those kind of guys. And it just, you have to be careful of what you wish for, because after I went to a military school, I was baptized. I went to a church all through that. In military school, I had to go to church.
What age were you when you went to the military school?
A 7th, 8th, and 9th into 10th grade.
Okay.
And then I kind of just got turned off, and that was pretty much the last time I even went to church was then. It just made me not want to be part of it. And then I was rebellious anyway.
Okay.
And so that, which was why I was at military school. So right after military school, my dad got me a job at a restaurant in Orange County.
Did he do that because he felt like he needed to keep you busy?
Yes.
Okay.
He had a friend that was opening up this restaurant. Well, his friend was normal. The partner that was the other half of the restaurant was a leader of a crime family, basically. And my first day, I got there maybe a half hour early because you can't control when the bus is there. And I'm waiting out in front. And this guy pulls up in this brand new Cadillac. He gets out. He's got like, you know, the slacks, the shiny shoes. They're brown. And he's wearing a open silk shirt with gold cross and religious medal. And he's got a gold Rolex on. And he goes, hi, I'm Joey. And I guess you're working here. And I was like, oh, this is the guy that I want to be like.
He looked like the sharp-dressed man you wanted to be.
This is it.
This is my hero?
This is the kind of person. Okay. And immediately when I was there, because they didn't even have a liquor license, I used to rent the liquor store and get booze for all these guys. They'd give me a 20, and then they would say, keep the change. So I'd get, you know, this is the 80s, so I'd get about $15. I just started noticing that these guys were different than everybody else. They were all gangsters. And it was during that time period, I found out there, all of them were high-level cocaine dealers. Every one of them was huge. But there was one group of people that was set up even above them, and that was traditional mafia guys in the mafia, like in the LCA and the Italian-American mafia. And everyone would look at them like, you know, there was regular criminals, there was drug smugglers, and then there was like mob guys. And then everyone was like, oh, and they would whisper about those guys. And that's what I thought to myself, I want to do that. One of the guys said to me one day, he goes, oh, here's your tip. And he pulled up a napkin and it was a rock of cocaine. And I took it and then I showed it to a friend at school. He was an older guy that I had gone to military school with. And he was like, where'd you get that? Do you know how much that's worth? And, you know,
Did you know how much it was worth?
I did not know how much it was worth, but we ended up getting about $400 for it. This is back, you know, my pay was $92 a week or every 2 weeks.
Wow,
it was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And after that, then he's like, do you think you can get more? And so that was the beginning of my time right there.
So you began to deal.
And then I just graduated from that to moving. I started to be most deliveries. And then as soon as I can drive, then I would drive at places. And then I became graduated before when I was 17, 18 years old to flying at places.
Flying drugs?
Yeah, well, I get on the plane.
Yes.
Back then, you didn't have to. In the 80s, you didn't need ID, and you can buy tickets even from anywhere. So I would go to Hawaii, especially Hawaii was one of my routes because, you know, I'm Asian and I don't look the part. So I could carry like 3 to 4 kilos, maybe 5 kilos in my backpack.
Were you ever scared?
No.
Wow.
Like, you know, I just wasn't. I would go to a travel agent and I would buy a round trip ticket for like, say, Wednesday. And then I would go to another travel agent and I'd buy another round trip ticket coming back for that same Wednesday at a different airline. So I would go there, drop off, and then dump the other ticket and then get back on this one, but under a different name.
As a teenager. You were bold.
Yeah. You know, and then after that, it just progressed. I mean, the problem with that life is that everyone makes it seem okay. It became normal, like getting arrested, seeing people get killed. It just became
normal. Were there people from your personal life, like say your family, did they have any idea what was going on?
My family had no idea what was going on. But basically, my mom and dad had divorced, and my mom had moved, and I was living with my dad in Orange County, and my dad worked all the time, and you know, he was just older, and so I kind of just did whatever I wanted to, and it just progressed from there. Once I was able to drive on my own, I bought my own car, bought my own motorcycle, I just kept going up. I call it riding the tiger. Like the boy gets on the tiger, he starts going to the jungle, and you go farther and farther and farther, but you can't get off because it'll just eat you.
So you felt like there was no way out?
I was already so deep into it that and I already had my future, my career is planned. Like when everyone else is going to college, I'm doing my next drug run literally the next morning after graduation. Yeah. And I decided that I just wanted to, this is what I wanted to do. And even—
What was the appeal? Was it the money?
Yeah, well, it all that. It's money, it's the power, and it's the glamour. See, this is the part that is deceiving to everyone is when you watch Hollywood movies or you read these books, they all glamorize his lifestyle. There's nothing glamorous about it at all. A lot of heartache, and there's many, many bad times, and there's not many good times. But at the time when I was young, I felt like I didn't even think I would live to 1999, to be honest with you. I always thought that I would flame out, get killed, or be arrested and put in prison for life. And so you grow up with that, but you try to make as much as you can and do it, and money drives you. It drove me, but then I can't really do anything with it anyway. So I would just have it in a safety deposit box, have it in a shoebox in my house, bury it somewhere, and I would just claim that gave me freedom, that I can fly wherever I want and do whatever
so
I want.
So there's mind games going on. Yeah. You're telling yourself one thing, but that sounds like recipe for depression eventually, but I don't know. Yeah. Were you just running so fast and hard that—
Yeah, but it's part of the life. Like you just look at it like— Okay. About this time, I started figuring that I was the luckiest person in the world. I used to tell this to everyone, actually say this, because I had this power of positive thinking. I was one of those big consumers of those books. Only I didn't use it for good purposes. I used it for bad, to expand my business. You know, I would say, I'm the luckiest guy around because I wouldn't get arrested. People would get killed and I wouldn't. I was supposed to go with somebody. I didn't. Like one of my friends, Joey, was actually pulling out of his restaurant one night. And I went out and stopped him. I'm like, hey, where are you going? He's like, oh, I'm just going to go pick up my girlfriend. I'm going to go down the street. I'm like, do you want me to go with you? And he's like, oh, no, I'm okay. And he ended up getting machine gunned to death that night.
Oh my goodness.
So, but that was like one of the incidents when I thought, you know, that I'm the luckiest human in the world.
Did you feel, I hate to use this word, but it's just perfectly described. Did you feel like you were untouchable, that there was just something about you?
Yeah. I thought that I was like bulletproof. And then like things would happen. Like I would get arrested. I would go down and then I would be locked up and then I would get bail. I'd get the lawyer. He'd get me bail. And then I would get out and I'd say, push it for 3-4 years, keep me out as long as possible so I can make as much. It would go on for a long time. And then like the charges would get dropped.
So you just skating along.
Right. I would like skate through this. The judge would feel sorry for me. So he'd go, oh, I'll give you a year and a day. And we'd say, we take it. You know,
how much time did you spend in jail?
Like on the installment program, the longest period was a year.
You spend a year in jail?
But over the time, it's like 3 or 4, like total. So I figured, I'm the luckiest person in the world. And so everything, when I envisioned something, I would meet the people. So like I wanted to be in the mob. And I got into the porno business in LA because as soon as the cocaine business like really imploded, or the early 90s was pretty much the end of that. So I got into the pornography business. I lived in LA, and it's just a natural, anything seedy and gray area, that's where organized crime could prosper. So pornography and gambling, bookmaking, were my two fortes, if you want to say that. Mm-hmm. But I had met a few guys when I was, you know, in the restaurant, in that business, and they introduced me to other guys, and I ended up meeting a guy named Jimmy Cacci, who was a capo, or a capo regime in the Italian mafia in Los Angeles family. He's a street boss. And we became real friendly. He spent most of his life in prisons. And so at the time when I first met him, he was going, and he's like, here's my number. And that just brought me deeper and deeper. And he introduced me to, he took me around to all the porn places in Los Angeles and introduced me like as his, as with him, which means I'm like part of, you know, part of his crew. And that's how I got into that. And at first I thought that business was like real glamorous and because, you know, it's show business. And you get to, you know, you go hang out with rock stars and movie stars, and you go to all the clubs and everything.
How long did that shine last?
That lasted till I was about 28 years old. And then, even then again, now I'm stuck in the business because I'm making money doing it. And then you just start to see like, and you see the sad story. I could close my eyes and I still think about it sometimes when I hear certain songs. I'd be in the back room and we'd see, you know, 300 new girls just about every week. And I listen to the stories and they're all the same. It's all the same. They come from a broken home, single parent, usually grow up with mom, looking for that daddy figure. And they're stuck in this, and they're all of them are just working to do something, but it never comes to fruition because they all want the quick dollar. They're used to immediate gratification. Yeah. So I close my eyes and it's like sad. And like, it starts wearing on you. So that was like the beginning of it. Mm-hmm. And then me, like, you know, the sports betting, it's the same thing. You're dealing with people's vices, their addictions. And so when I was taking, I take sports bets and then we'd loan out money, do shylocking, which is loan sharking. But you're always dealing with like these people that, even though they appear to be like, you know, a successful businessman or something, they have this like addiction.
Did you have some compassion?
Well,
something stirring in
you? Yeah, I was feeling bad about that. And then in 1996, I was in Providence, Rhode Island, and I got a call from somebody, and they said the FBI had just come by and they left a card for me. And I said, well, why would they go by your house? And I have my business. They know how to get a hold of me. I mean, they arrested me multiple times at the same address. I'm like, give me the guy's name. And so they gave me the name and I'm like, that's weird. So I called the main FBI office. And
you called the FBI?
Yeah. I mean, this is what you do. You don't like, it's not like on TV where you have like a bad relationship with them. I know all the guys, you know what I mean? Like they've arrested me and they treat you with respect.
Wow.
And so I called the main FBI office and I asked for this man and they said, yeah, hold on a second. And they got him. So now I know that he is actually a real FBI.
Real.
Yeah. And so I talked to him and he's like, hey, listen, we want to talk to you. And I'm like, oh, great. Now I'm getting arrested again. And I've just, the longest period of time, and I'm going to tell this to you, from age 13 till I was 36 years old, the longest period of time I was free, not on parole or probation or in custody, was 3 months. And this was the 3 months right then before I talked to him.
Kenji, yeah. How did you, that just seems like that would wear a person down.
It was
down.
Just like my normal part of life. Like I told you, it was like completely everyone around me
was
doing
the same thing.
It's hard to
imagine, but I got you. Okay.
So I called him and he says, hey, we want to talk to you. And I'm in Providence, Rhode Island. I said, I'm going to Los Angeles. I'll be back in 3 weeks and then I'll call you guys. You make sure you call me. And I said, okay. So when I finally got to Los Angeles, I agreed to meet them at a deli. And so I told everyone I'm going to jail. So
You told all your associates?
Yeah, I said, yeah, I'm going to jail. I'm getting arrested.
Okay, and this is a normal part of life,
yeah,
so they didn't think that was a big deal.
So
okay.
I left my watch. I left everything I have and my cell phone. And then I brought $20 with me because that's it. And my driver's license, nothing else. You don't need anything else. So I get to this deli and there's two FBI agents waiting outside and they're like, hey, you're here. You're like, do you have a cell phone? I'm like, no. They're like, do you have any weapons on you? And I'm like, no, of course not. And they're like, can we check? And I go ahead. So they said, when I walk into this deli, they're like, okay, we're going to go in this private room. But they're like, don't freak out. There's a whole bunch of agents in there. So these two guys are walking behind me. I walk in and I'm like, it's a pretty big room, decent size with a big table. And there's eight other agents in there. I was like, oh. But I freaked out. And they're like, guys, like, one guy stood up and he said, relax, relax, relax. We're not arresting you. And I go, okay. They're like, sit down. We want to talk to you. They said, look, we watch you. We've known you since you're 18 years old. And they're like, you know that you're going to get arrested. You're going to get killed. We're going to put you away for life. Or you're going to get killed. And that's the end of this will be it. And I said, yeah, I know. And at this point, I already knew that the life was...
there was an expiration date on it.
And I wanted out, like, because I didn't want to end up like Joe or any of my other friends. Because once you get a certain age, it's like you got to go all out, or you go to prison for the rest of your life, or you just die. My expiration date was coming up. I was looking for a way out, and they said, look, we want you to come work for Team USA. And I'm like, I don't want to be a rat. Like, I don't want to talk. I don't want to tell any of my friends. And they said, we don't even care about the guys in LA, but we care because you travel everywhere. We are interested in the intelligence. And I go, well, what do I get out of it? And they said, the only thing you're going to get out of this whole deal is a fresh start. And he goes, just like this, oof, end of everything, new you.
Kenji had always said he was the luckiest guy in the world. Was this just more good luck? Could a clean slate from the FBI, this fresh start, could that bring him happiness? Part two of Kenji's story is coming up. But first, a word from our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. So why are you passionate about leadership?
When I was a kid, I was really shy and things were happening to me. I wasn't in charge of my life. I was timid. I was compliant. My life changed where I started impacting people for good. And if I could do it, anybody could do it. I'm passionate because most people operate at 50% probably of their potential. What would happen if you just unleash the power of your car to be twice as powerful? I think we can unleash the power of our soul to be twice as powerful while at the same time be a good influence for Jesus in a good way. If it's like ripples, you just throw a stone in a pond and you ripple. If I can help somebody and that somebody goes and exceeds me and is helping a lot more people, that would be so awesome.
So if somebody wanted to learn more about leadership, they're hearing the passion that you have, they want to develop their leadership skills. Where can they go and what can they learn?
They can come to HabibHabib.com. They'll know my story. They'll know many motivational minutes and some of the speeches that I have given, engagements that I've done. And so there's a lot of activity over at HabibHabib.com.
And now back to Kenji Gallo's story.
Only thing you're going to get out of this whole deal is a fresh start. And he goes, just like this, woof, end of everything, new you. And I thought, this is great. This is what I really wanted.
Did it seem like dream come true?
See, again, this is where I thought I'm the luckiest person in the world. See, now I'm getting a way out. So I asked him, how long will this be? And he goes, 6 months to a year tops. And I said, okay, no problem. They're like, do you want to talk to your lawyer about it? I'm like, no, he's probably on your list of the people that you're going to want to get. Because if I tell you, I'll be killed because he was bad. So I said, okay. I started working right away for them.
Were you scared?
No. Same as what I always did. And they would tell me where to go and gather intelligence. And then
you wear a wire? How do you gather the intelligence?
Well, I had a wire. I had a wire in my Rolex watch and one in my belt buckle. It's an MP3 player, so it would last for 13 hours. The belt buckle lasts for 9. So I would switch them out like every couple of days. They made a duplicate, so there was two of each.
I see. So when you're about to have a conversation, you turn it on.
Oh, no. The time I leave my house, I turn it on. And I give the date and my code name was Break Shot. I never said my name. Like no one, the only agents that knew me were my actual case agents. The rest of them only know me as Break Shot. Even when I'm introduced to agents, they call me Break Shot. That's the way they compartmentalize that. So 6 months, year went past and I'm still doing this. And then they wanted me to move to New York, to Brooklyn, because I had been offered to move to Brooklyn to be with the Colombo family. So I said, okay. The original agent, who was my case agent, retired because I was around so long. And he brought me a junior agent named John. John was with me for another 6 years.
Six years?
In Brooklyn.
That has to be a record. Is that a record?
I don't think it is, but it's pretty close. And when I was living in Brooklyn, that's when it got really, it's like ground zero in the mafia. We had to come up with new ways to meet in the city. And I have to switch out the wire every day. So in the morning, I would go jogging and someone would bump me into a bagel shop and give me another, bag of bagels. But
this went on for 6 years?
8 years total.
8 years total.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just imagining, keeping up that kind of deception, did it begin to wear on you?
Yeah. This is when it made me real sick and real tired and I was real depressed. And I really wanted to quit in Brooklyn. It pretty much came to a head, and this is what I look back on my life. This is the main turning point, is I was with a guy named Teddy Persico. He was a street boss of the Colombo family. His uncle's still the boss. And one day he decided that he was going to take me along on a murder, a hit. They had taken me out to lunch in Brooklyn, him and a guy named Eddie. They said, hey, we'll drive you home. I'm sitting in the back of the car, and Teddy says, hey, we're going to go deal with Craig and Georgie. And Craig, he is another Colombo guy like us, but they had an internal civil war. And during the civil war, Craig was on the other side. So he tried to kill Teddy's dad and some other people. And so now they're going to even up the score now. I have the wire on. I'm recording this. And he's like, we're going to go to my mother's house. We're going to get the gear, guns, and we're going to deal with this. So I was like, oh man, I got to call the FBI because I can't do any violence. I can't do anything, but I can't leave the car. We're rolling. So he's talking about meeting this guy in front of this restaurant. He's going to take him down by the water. And we're driving and thinking, I got to let the FBI know. What am I going to do? This is bad. And this is unfolding so quick that I cannot stop it. So as we come over this little rise, there's a huge hook and ladder. There is a paramedic and there's two NYPD squad cars. It looks in front of the restaurant where we're going, but it's actually in the restaurant next door. And as we go by, Teddy starts screaming, they're already here. We haven't even done anything yet. And I'm thinking in my mind, the FBI has me wired. They've got me covered. I'm looking, they're wheeling out a guy. He's having a heart attack. They're wheeling out this guy. And then the NYPD guys are sitting in their car, relaxing in front. So Teddy says, look, it's off. He goes, tell my brothers that it's off. I'm going to take this kid down by the water and I'm going to deal with it, but nothing's going to go down. I'm just going to yell at him. And I'm like, okay. And then Teddy dropped me up at home. And he said to me, he goes, I think I made it okay with Craig, but never turn your back on him. Like, you know, I didn't want to be part of this. Craig was my friend before this. Now he wants to kill me. And so at that point, I was like,
that was it.
I was so shaken up about this that that was pretty much over Brooklyn at that point. And that tape, actually, it was able to prosecute a lot of people from what went down because we tape recorded the whole thing. It turns out the FBI wasn't recording me. I was recording, but it was a recorder only. It wasn't a transmitter. Mm-hmm. They were all off. It was past 5 o'clock on a Friday.
They had no idea.
They already got no one had any idea until I turned it in. I ended up flying up to Canada. I was going to work and I ended up staying there and never going back. I stayed there for 3 weeks and then they flew me back to Washington, D.C. for debriefing. And then they flew me to...
Did you just say, I'm done? I'm really done? How does that happen?
They decided that it was too dangerous for me. And as soon as I disappeared, then they had a big meeting about me and the guys decided that I was going to rat. So they took a vote to kill me. And actually the only person that said no was Teddy, which is the weirdest part because he's actually the most violent of all of them. So after that, I never went back and I was at safe houses and I was in the WITSEC, Witness Protection Program. And they flew me from place to place and I was in a safe house, which is really just a Marriott hotel in Idaho.
That's your safe house?
Yeah, I lived in a hotel suite in Idaho for 18 months. And when I was there, I had no ID or anything. And that's when I just started, I worked out and I ran every day and I just started.
Was your fresh start.
Well, I was doing nothing. And so I used to go, I would listen to myself and go over tapes and then transcribe the tapes for them. And I did a couple of weeks because I had nothing else to do. And I would read books all day long and decide what I'm going to do with my life. But at this point I decided, okay, I'm going to be a good person. I'm never going to commit crime anymore. And I hadn't committed any since 96 that I promised them I wouldn't. But I said, I'm going to be a good person. Once I got my new ID and everything, then I signed out of the protection program and I quit. Like, I didn't want to be part of that anymore. And I went out on my own and I left to Europe and I went over to Spain and and I started writing in my book, which was Breakshot. And I went to the Vatican. I went to all these places, you know, the Sistine Chapel. And I didn't really feel anything. It wasn't for me. But I said to myself, I'm going to be a good person. And this is, again, with the Tony Robbins, you know, not to badmouth anyone, but it's still, I'm doing the same.
Power of positive thinking.
Power of positive thinking, Norman Vincent Peale, all these things like that. You know, I sold my book. I did real well with the book. I started doing a lot of interviews. I was on TV shows.
Were you using a different name than your name in the mob?
No, Kenji Gallows is my name.
Were you worried?
No. I mean, I'm the same person that I was then, not. And in real life, if you kill a federal witness in real life, it's over. One guy made a threatening phone call and they recorded the whole thing. And they called me and they're like, did you just get that? And I said, yeah, I just heard it. And they're like, do you know who it is? And I'm like, yeah, it's Chris. It's so-and-so's cousin. And they're like, okay, we're going to go get the payphone. So they went and they took the payphone, the whole thing, dusted it for prints, found his thumbprint on one of the coins. He got 6 years for that, for threatening me. But so in real life, that's what happens. And so once I was in LA, I started working in Hollywood. I got on TV shows. I was on radio shows all the time.
Telling your story.
Right. But I sold my book to TV. I sold it to Fox. And I started thinking like, oh yeah, you know. And then I'm in the life. I'm like, I have a mortgage company. I'm like doing well. Money's coming in. And like, but I'm a good person. See, basically what I was doing is I'm still a mobster, but not in the mob, not doing illegal stuff. I still have the same attitude. It's all about money to me. I got to get the car. Got to do this. I got to do that. And so I was living that Hollywood lifestyle, writing screenplays, selling them. And I was training people like, you know, mixed martial arts and like kickboxing and boxing and jiu-jitsu, because it's what I do. And I was just training movie stars, and I fell into this life of no meaning. And I kept thinking there's something else. I'm like,
were you any happier then than you were when you were doing the mob stuff?
Well, I was happier, but I was still depressed. My life was just really going nowhere. Mm-hmm. And then one day I had gotten a fight at the gym with another trainer. And one of the guys I trained, he's like an actor. I really like him and I liked his shows. And I really like the guy. So he says, hey, let me take you out to lunch. It's on me. And I go, okay. So we walk to this restaurant and we order, and I've just started to drink my water. And he goes, you know, you're a real spiritual guy, man. Have you ever thought about Jesus Christ? And I was like, oh no, I'm caught. Now I'm stuck. And I really like this guy too. He's a real likable guy. He's a real nice guy.
But you wanted to get out of there as fast as you could.
Right, huh? When I heard that, I was like, oh, our food's not even here. But then he said, listen, I'm just going to tell you a story. And he told me the story about himself. You know, I had some successes acting, and then I didn't have any success. And then I was going to get a job as a construction guy, started construction work on the next Monday. I had borrowed money from my dad, and I went to church and I prayed about it. Like, if this is what I'm supposed to do, I'm going to do it. I'm fine with it. I'm just going to go back to school and do this. And he goes, and I got a call later that night to do an audition. He goes, sure, I'll do it, but I'm starting work somewhere else. He went and did this audition, and he said, I kind of blew it off. It was okay. I didn't think I did a good job. He said, they called me back that Friday. He said, hey, can you be on location on Monday? And he said, I can't because I don't have the money. They're like, we'll advance the money. And he ended up getting this big TV show, and he's never looked back since. And then he stopped. That was it. He never said another word about the rest of the lunch. So then it got me thinking. And then this other guy who was a client of mine sent me a Bible to my house. And my dog used to, anything that got thrown over my gate, I had this black lab, she would eat everything, like tear it apart into shreds. And so whenever like the UPS man or the FedEx man would throw something over the gate, it would be shredded, destroyed. So I come home one day, there's a package, pieces of package all the way up, just ripped up, bubble wrap. And like laying against the door, like if someone propped it, was a Bible.
Untouched?
Untouched. Not ripped, no teeth mark, nothing. And she ripped up everything. I thought, oh, wow. So then I told my wife, I think I want to go to church. And she's like, yeah. She's like behind it. So we decided to go on Christmas Eve. I was so scared to go. I was like butterflies in my stomach. I felt sick. My legs were shaking. We parked. I thought, everyone's going to know that I'm a fraud, that I haven't been. Because I always had thought that Christians, like when I was locked up, like priests would come and talk to me. And I'd be like, and you hear other cons talk. And they're always like this. When everyone's in trouble, they want to be a Christian. And I just didn't want to be like that. And I always thought that Christians were weak. And I'm like, oh. But we went in and we started singing. We started listening to the pastor. And then it's like everything came to me. And it was like I felt peace. But like, because I had surrendered to Jesus at that point, to the Holy Spirit. Like I felt I wasn't trying to do it on my own, like fix it.
Yeah.
And I realized that I couldn't fix everything. It was from then on that I think we started Bible study like the next week. And
you jumped in.
Yeah. But I mean, it was like, it all came back to me. Like before I had a block, like I looked at the Bible and it didn't mean anything to me. I looked at it and then the next week we were doing Bible study and I was like to some ladies having problems. And I'm like, you can't see this? It's written right here.
So suddenly the Bible like just came to you?
Yes. I had done this when I was a kid and I knew all the stories, but I didn't remember, but I had tried to read the Bible since then. Like when I was locked up, when you're in the hole, they could take away anything, but they can't take away your religious, but like a Bible. So I would have a Bible and I would read it, but it was just like a story. And then it just like, wow, I know what this means. And then everyone thinks right when you become a Christian, like life's just going to be peachy.
Oh, it all falls into place.
It all
right?
falls into place. But it doesn't. It's ongoing. It's work. And it's like constantly. And I realize like, look, I have a lot of things I need to fix on my own. First of all, I take personal responsibility for everything. That's why I don't sit here and I'm not giving you a story about blaming everyone else and my upbringing, because my upbringing was fine. It was me. I started having to take responsibility for everything and care about people, other people besides myself, and do things. And then there's a lot of tough time, you know? We decided that we were going to leave Los Angeles and leave that life behind. And Los Angeles is easy because I know everybody. Mm-hmm. And I could always get money and get work for doing like nothing. It's just easy. But that's not what I'm looking for. So we decided to move to Illinois. and I moved to a farm. I mean,
you couldn't have gone farther from where you've been.
I've never lived off the coast in my whole life. I could always live where I could see the ocean, basically, or be close to the ocean or mountains or something. And then I got here, and it's like, you know, it's hard. Life is hard. But I know through hard work and trusting in the Lord and putting my faith in Him that I did the right thing. We prayed about it to move. Like everything just started working, you know, falls into place. And then you have ups and downs, you have good times and bad times, but part of getting through the bad times are the lessons that you have to learn. And it's not like, why is this happening to me? It's not about me, you know? It's about, it's what the Lord wants. And I just got to go to Israel. You know, I got to walk where Jesus did and His disciples. And, you know, being there and being in Galilee and all that and being able to walk and being able to see all these places, it just made me think. And, you know, I got baptized in the Jordan River. It was just like amazing to me. And trusting and like having faith and knowing that, yeah, I have problems. Like my life is not great. And like I work really hard. I have a gym. At our gym, we train Parkinson's patients like for this thing called Rock City Boxing. And I see them. But the fact that my fighting ability, my training ability could help these people, it actually makes them better. This, to me, is worth it. So when I told you I was the luckiest person in the world, I look back. Okay, I wasn't the luckiest person in the world. It was like part of God's plan. You know, I just wasn't meant to be part of that. He had something else for me. Now, I don't know what that is, but maybe it's to get my story out more and to show people, tell people. This is how I live my life, and it's worked out. And I was a big doubter before. And now this is the new me. It's different. I'm different. But I see that you just have to have faith and you can't do it alone. Like all that positive thinking and all that stuff, that's good, but it's not going to get you anywhere, especially when you don't have any like moral boundaries and restrictions. See, I lived a life like of hedonism and like no boundaries, just do whatever I want. And I used to always want to get revenge on somebody. You know, someone yells at me and I'm like, my old self would be like, oh, I got to run back and do something. Now I'm just like, I just kind of like, and I might get mad for a brief second, but it's not. It's not my job.
You're a new creation.
I guess we all had to be born again, right? Like that's what it is. So yeah.
When you talked about dealing with all of the stuff that you had done, what did that look like for you? Did you have to go and apologize to anybody or what?
I actually apologized to people. When I was writing the first book, when I was writing Breakshot, I was like, oh man. I mean, it was bad.
When you realized the list of things?
It was horrible. I was like, and then that's another reason why I kind of just got, I stopped wanting to be in LA so much is because that's all anyone ever wanted from me was that.
To hear about that stuff of your life.
And also like to glorify, they really wanted to glorify, like in all the movie people and everything, they make up these movies where these guys are wearing suits all the time in their life. They live in this huge mansion. And all this stuff is farthest from the truth. It's not like that. And it's not glamorous and it's not fun. And you try to tell them that and they don't want to hear it. So I just like, I don't want to be part of that. I don't mind telling the story if it's going to do something, but I don't want to glorify that and just talk about that.
Yeah.
So I just needed to change and I've done it.
But the root of it for you was surrendering. Is that what it was like when you went to church that day?
Yeah, it was like surrendering, like the Holy Spirit came. All that positive power, positive thinking, all that, yes, I can. It could get me a little while, but it's not going to get me where I want to be. And also my life was like this way. I always felt empty. And I have felt like that since grade school. Like I was missing something. Very like, you know, sad, like unhappy. But you could mask it over when you're making money and running around and, you know, doing this. But, you know, like in the cold, dark hours, the truth, you know, hits you and you alone. You know it. You know that what you're doing is not, you're not getting you anywhere. So I was empty and I felt that empty feeling for so long. After going back to church, I've not had that feeling. And I think it's like, it helped me. It brought me closer to my wife. It brought me closer. I brought all these new people into my life. I started getting congratulated for things not bad, you know, not being known for that. Like I didn't want to go to my grave being known as a mobster. You know, God took me in a different direction. Like to opening a gym wasn't part of what I was going to do. I just started doing that. And we started working with different people and I enjoy it. And I started writing on the side. I kept writing. And
so when you think of yourself, if you can be objective and take a step away, what do you see as the biggest change in you?
My biggest change is that I actually have hope in my life and like I'm a different person. It's strange, but I look back at myself and I'm appalled at the stuff that I did and the way I acted. And now it's like I have a lot of compassion for other people. Like I'm sure I had compassion for people, but I just pushed it down before. And because I only thought about myself. Now I think about everyone else. Because before, in the mob life, it's all about the organization and what you can do for it, and also how you're going to get ahead. And that's it. Hedonistic. That's it. And now I'm not like that. Now I think, well, what does my wife want? And I try to be more understanding and do it. And I think I'm getting there.
Sitting across from Kenji, it was really hard to imagine that he was ever in the mafia. The change is so dramatic. There have been TV shows made about Kenji's life, but he says all of those tend to glorify mafia life. And the truth is, it was a one-way ticket to death. He says he is a real-life example of moving from death to life, from dark to light. Today, Kenji and his wife own a gym where they work hard, they help others. He's also working on a new book that's all about how Jesus has changed his life. It's called Redemption. From the darkness comes light. Thanks so much to Kenji for sharing his incredible story. Thanks so much for listening, sharing, and posting kind reviews. And a little something to celebrate. Last week, The Unfolding won the Spark Media Podcast Award for Best Interview-Based Podcast. How fun is that? Hey, we're working on a number of episodes coming up in this next series of 10. We would really love to do a story on someone who has experienced what's happening in Ukraine firsthand. If you know of someone with a story, I'd love to hear about it. You can reach out to me on the Unfolding Podcast Facebook page. Well, we couldn't do what we do without our amazing team, producer Jason Rakow, Danielle Perez, and Elena Nowlin, and our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H-Squared Leadership Institute. Find out how to unleash the full power of your leadership potential at HabibHabib.com. The Unfolding is produced by Northwestern Media, a ministry of the University of Northwestern St. Paul. We'll be back next week with another page of The Unfolding.